done right the first time by Slava. So we're going to get it away with that. That's what we've done. And he reminds me, to remind you of a new book on an introduction to quantum methods in the engineering ground, which is being published by Cambridge. Cambridge has also published this great book by the non-standard model, it turns out. So without any further ado, let me give you a sign.
The course is called Advanced Topic in Cosmology, but of course I will begin with very unadvanced stuff. And also, I will try to present things actually in the most simple possible way, concentrating mostly after this introduction, which I will make today, on inflation, theory of cosmological perturbation, and CMB fluctuations. If I will have time, I would like also to tell you about analytical derivation of the abundances of the light elements in the universe, about nuclear synthesis, but it depends. So, let me begin lecture with reminding you basic observational facts from cosmology, not from astrophysics, but from cosmology, because fortunately or unfortunately, it happened that the experiment in cosmology happened to be much better than in astrophysics, with much less systematics. But of course, the number of facts which we know from cosmology is very limited, and these facts we have to keep in mind when we are speaking about theory. Yeah? So what are these facts? First of all, we know that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic in scales larger than 100 megaparsecs. And has well-developed structure in the scales much smaller than 100 megaparsecs. In particular, we have galaxies, clusters of galaxies, and about other things you know yourself, of course, stars, planets, etc. Now, second thing which we know is that it expands according to the Hubble law. Expands according to the Hubble law. So this is the only law which is compatible with isotropy and homogeneity at all moments of time. Yeah? Now, homogeneity and isotropy on all scales. When it was firmly established? In fact, not very long time ago, perhaps 5 years ago, not more. 25 years ago, it was just postulated. So-called cosmological principle. Why? Because we have mostly two-dimensional observation of the distribution of the matter on large scales. Since we had no sample, for instance, complete sample of galaxies with all red shifts. Therefore, we could imagine that, in fact, okay, maybe it's crazy, but nevertheless possible situation that we are living in the center of spherically symmetric universe, and everything would be in agreement with observations. But the whole situation changed when people began this slow digital survey, because they took the red shift of more than half of million of galaxies, and then they discovered special distribution of the matter in the space. And what they have seen, that, of course, there are big clusters of galaxies, there are filaments, there are voids, but if you would smear the distribution of the matter on the scales larger than 100 megaparsecs, then everything is more or less the same. Therefore, we know that we live in this universe. Expansion according to the Hubble law was discovered, in fact, much longer before. Perhaps with the wrong coefficient of proportionality, because this law tells us that the receding velocity of two faraway galaxies is proportional to what people call Hubble constant multiplied by the distance between the galaxies. This Hubble constant is not in fact constant, it depends on time, but because it doesn't depend on the distance, people call it constant. You see, and at the beginning, this Hubble constant was measured with the error of the order of 10. So, and since if you would take, for instance, forget about gravity, take distance between the galaxies and divide it by receding velocity, you would get 1 divided by h the time when two galaxies were together. So it's the beginning of the universe. So if you would take here the value which Hubble wrote from the very beginning, then you would get that the age of the universe is, I guess, estimate was about 1 billion years. So it was in contradiction even with the age of the Earth. But then people made a lot of efforts, of course, to correct this thing, because it's very difficult to determine this thing. For this Hubble constant, for that you have to have good standard candles. And people for a very long time had no good standard candles. Therefore, this was the quantity which was most badly determined in cosmology. For a very long time, there were, in particular, two groups. One group was Vakulev. Yeah? He used one kind of standard candles, and he was getting here about 100 kilometers over second of a megaparsec for a very long time. There was the other group of people, Sandich and others, who were claiming that this Hubble constant is 50. So theorists were taking always at this time 75. To please all experimentalists. Now, of course, situation improved very much since then. And now this Hubble constant is established from CMB fluctuations mostly, with accuracy perhaps 7-10%. Yeah, not too much also, but now people found that it's 70. So series view correct. As you understand. As usual. Okay, good. Now, these two facts refers to so-called large-scale dynamics of our universe, right? But our universe, of course, has some kind of matter content. And what we know about this matter content? We know that the universe is pervaded by thermal radiation. Radiation with the temperature 2.73, and there are two more numbers known here, Kelvin. You see, as also you know, this radiation was discovered accidentally by Penzias and Wilson in 1964 or 65, and at the same time, actually, people in Princeton, Dickey, Peebles, and other people were preparing the experiment to discover this radiation. But they were unfortunate because Penzias and Wilson found it just by chance without taking care about cosmology. It was noise in their radio antenna, and in fact, they at the beginning had no idea, if you read Weinberg's book, yeah, what is this. But then one of the person from their group was in Princeton on the seminar. He heard about this project which people in Princeton were going to do. So he came back and told these guys what they discovered, in fact. And what for? They got later Nobel Prize. Now, temperature of this radiation was known also, okay, 3 plus minus 0.3. But now, temperature of this radiation was measured with unbelievable accuracy by Mazur in this COBE experiment, because they had very ingenious measurements there. And you see, they got, I have all these pictures, but just I don't want to interrupt with nice pictures. The presentation, you see, they measured this Planckian curve with unbelievable accuracy. If you want to see here arrow bars on this Planckian curve, people usually give 400 sigma arrow bars. Could you imagine? Because if you would forget about 400 sigma, then you would see that just points are precisely on this curve, and it's like, okay, falsified by student experiment made in the lab who didn't think about putting arrow bars. You see? So now, and Mazur, of course, got Nobel Prize together with Smoos mostly for this experiment. Because fluctuation of the ground radiation, I mean, the new discovery was, I think, it was Smoos who was responsible for it. Now, we know also that there are baryonic matter in the universe. This I don't need to prove you, yeah, you see. Around. And we have one baryon per about 10^9 photons. So, because the entropy of the radiation is proportional to the number of photons, or to proportional to the temperature Q, you see that there is incredible entropy in the universe per one baryon. Now, there is 75% of hydrogen in our universe, this baryon form, as chemical element, 25% of helium, 4, yeah? But you tell me that there are 100% already, so what we are made of. But the other elements really are present in small trace amounts. For instance, there is deuterium in the amount about 10 minus 4. There are other light elements. There are heavy elements with which we mostly familiar, yeah? But of course, all these elements are present in negligible amount. Heavy elements, as we know, were formed in supernova. The question is about these light elements and how we form helium 4. Because, of course, natural way to form helium 4, you know that. In, of course, thermonuclear bomb, in hydrogen bomb. Yeah? And in fact, what we have in the sun, we have actually this hydrogen explosion, which goes all the time. But if we would try to produce 25% of helium-4 in these thermonuclear explosions, then the brightness in our universe, the brightness of the matter would be at least 100 times larger than we see today. You see, it's clear that in the stars, this helium could not be produced. So where it could be produced? Only in the very early universe, when the temperature was very high. When the temperature was very high, incredibly high, you could explode even in the medium nuclear bomb and nobody will pay attention to it. Yeah? So and this thing happened, in fact, in universe. So these nuclear bombs needed to explode, not nuclear, thermonuclear, yeah, hydrogen bomb. We exploded in very early universe, and then, okay, the things were cooled slowly. Of course, this is also things which is known for very long time, so-called nuclear synthesis. How people usually do it? They take computers, they take Wagner code, run all these reactions, and then they get some kind of curves, compare with observations, and they are, I don't know up to what extent you are impressed, usually, when you see the result of computer simulations, I don't impressed very much, because I do not understand what is going on there. You see the basic processes. And only people who run all these codes really know what happens. This was the reason why actually I tried to get all these abundances just analytically. There is a lot of nice physics here. And as I told you already, I will explain you why this physics is nice, but also very impressive. And here the most impressive element is perhaps deuterium. Why? Because deuterium, you see, 10 minus 4, you could think that it's not very much, yeah? But if you would try to get this abundance in the stars, you will not get it. Because deuterium has very, very low binding energy. It's about 2.3 MeV. In the stars, so if you would be producing, therefore, this deuterium in the stars, the maximum abundance which you could get there would be at the level of 10 minus 12. You see, and here it's a million times more. But of course, the abundance of this deuterium depends, which was produced in the very early universe, crucially on the amount of baryons which are present at this time. If you have too much baryons, then the reactions are faster, and this deuterium is burned away, and you do not get this kind of dependence. And here, the dependence of deuterium depends on the number of amount of the baryons, so actually here it's concentration of baryons, like this one. At the beginning it drops linearly with the amount of baryons, but at a certain point it starts to drop exponentially fast. And V lives somewhere here. It says that we have this amount of baryons, 4% of critical density is this amount of baryons. Therefore, deuterium is, in fact, very sensitive catalysator, or how it's called, indicator of the amount of baryons in our universe. And what we discovered here in nuclear synthesis is an impressive agreement with what we got from completely independent experiment for CMB fluctuation. Here. Now, of course, baryons constitute constitute 4% of the total energy density. And what K as semi-big, and the other is really great surprise, is the existence of so-called dark, invisible component of the matter in our universe. And moreover, people discovered that this dark component consists of two subcomponents, at least of two subcomponents. So people discovered that there is 22% of cold dark matter in our universe. And they discovered also that there is 74, now if I will add, yeah, correct, percent of dark energy. You see, what is the difference between dark matter and dark energy? Dark matter is something what has equation of state, pressure is equal to zero, so it's like dust, like equation of state, and something what could cluster. Okay, entering galaxies, clusters of galaxies, and explaining all these rotational curves, etc. And dark energy is the component which cannot be clustered. And moreover, it's some kind of component with negative effective pressure. You see? And this component leads to acceleration. Instead of deceleration of our universe, it could be some kind of scalar condensate, as we will see. It could be cosmological constant. Okay, which also could be considered as a scalar condensate or scalar field, whatever you want. And these kinds of things came completely unexpectedly because people were suspected, measuring rotational curves of galaxies, measuring, applying this virial theory to the clusters of galaxies, that there should be that matter in the universe. And the first guy who wrote about that matter was Zwicky. People then did a lot of job applying this virial theorem to the observational results for the clusters of galaxies. And in the 80s, people were always getting that there should be the amount of cold dark matter, okay, no, perhaps like 0.2 omega, so 20%. But nobody was managed to get more than 30%. Moreover, in 1995, when people were applying new techniques, they were never getting also the amount of dark matter more than 30%. You see, and you know, in 1995, there was inflation already, which was telling that omega total should be equal 1. Okay, 1 is these three numbers should be, okay, give you 100%. This was the reason why some people, okay, who were working on inflation started to panic and wrote a lot of crap, okay, which later became known open inflation. Yeah, and which damaged, I think, how it's called, the public opinion about inflation very much. But of course, you understand the theories usually are very sophisticated and you can never rule out any theory because the guy always will find the way how to avoid introducing one extra parameter. Doesn't matter. But several years ago, after that, there was discovered this dark energy component, and it was discovered first measuring, how to call this, taking, observing supernova at very large redshifts. It became possible. Why? Because now everything substituted computers. So computers are working instead of us. We just have to find out what does they produce, yeah? Or what does this really mean? Because when people, of course, we observe this supernova, you could imagine actually, from supernova, it's so large distance, you could not see it even there. So it's a kind of galaxy which changes its brightness. Because during explosion of supernova, the brightness of supernova exceeds the brightness of the whole galaxy. But nevertheless, because this supernova is very far away from us, then we are getting 1-2 quanta per minute or per 10 minutes. So how could you see all this supernova? Because you cannot see, but electronic can see it. And when people actually measured this dependence of luminosity, brightness, about which I will be also speaking, as a function of the redshift, they discovered that they could understand this thing, I mean this measurement, only if universe is accelerated. You see? But, of course, as I told you, these observations are, in fact, astrophysical observations. What is the difference between physics and astrophysics? You know very well, yeah. In astrophysics, systematics is not under control. This is the reason, by the way, why the structure is more hierarchical in astrophysical community, because they need some bosses to tell how to reduce this systematics. You see? But, and of course, when people discover this kind of thing, first of all, in physics today, I guess, or maybe Scientific America, published immediately wrong paper. With the wrong front page. Where it was written down, inflation is in trouble. Instead of writing that inflation was nicely confirmed, because actually the missing energy was far, people wrote inflation is in trouble because inflation didn't predict cosmological constant. But you see, inflation never pretended to explain everything and to predict everything. So what it can, it can. What it cannot, then it cannot. Now, second thing, of course, I didn't trust in this cosmological constant. I had bet with Vilenkin, Alex Vilenkin, that cosmological constant will decay on the time scale, not 10 billion years, because this, in this case, we would never manage to bring the bet to the end, yeah, in half a year. In half a year, cosmological constant didn't decay. And in fact, after I started to think, I discovered that there is even more solid confirmation of this cosmological constant without systematics. It's the measurement of CMB fluctuation. Because, as I will try to explain you, given the height and location of the first Doppler peak, without cosmological constant, you cannot understand the existence of second Doppler peak. Yeah? If you would not make something very crazy like some people are doing, if you would not take Hubble constant 30 kilometers over second over megaparsec, after that break scale invariance of the spectra, after that do a couple of more things, write long paper, okay, which you could put in the grant proposal, but nobody will read it anyway. Yeah. So these kind of things I will not be discussing because there is all kind of variations. And of course, so these are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 things, okay, which are not so difficult to memorize. And there is the point number 7, which is extremely important. It's CMB fluctuations. CMB fluctuations. And what is this CMB fluctuations? You know that this thermal radiation, which we see right now, decoupled from the matter when our universe was 1,000 times smaller, and which was only 300,000 years old. And since then, this radiation was propagating free, of course, in a little bit dirty galaxy, which also puts some kind of prints on this photograph which we are getting. And this radiation gave us direct photograph of the very early universe. And then we could see directly there, in very early universe, when it was 1,000 times smaller, there was no galaxy. There was practically nothing. Yeah? And there were only tiny fluctuations of the energy density distribution in the matter at the level of 10 minus 5. After that, you take this picture of homogeneous smooth universe with these tiny fluctuations at the level of 10 minus 5. Then you use gravitational instability to evolve these fluctuations, and you are getting galaxies, clusters of galaxies, and everything. For that, you don't need anything besides of Newtonian dynamics. And of course, one of the basic things here is how to explain the origin of this tiny fluctuation, 10 minus 5. And one of the main purposes of my talk, of my lectures, not today talk, will be explanation of this small number and explanation of the spectra of these fluctuations. And I will try to convince you that perhaps it's the only useful application of so-called quantum gravity. Because I will try to explain these fluctuations as originated from quantum gravitational fluctuations in the scale 10 minus 33 centimeters. So, and then amplified by inflation. So in this sense, okay, if you would like to summarize what is inflation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to your good friend, you could tell him that the fact that we exist at all, what is responsible for that? For quantum gravity, you see? And this is the reason why quantum gravity should be funded. You could tell this thing to the public if you want. Because without quantum gravitational fluctuations, there would be nothing. No computers. Okay, good. Now. Okay, so now I will go to the standard 6. I will go fast through all these things. Therefore, if you know what I say, you can just sleep during this time. But I will need this thing just to introduce notation. And, of course, how it's called, to recall you what are the basic things about our unit. First, let's consider universe without fluctuation. Let's forget about these fluctuations, etc. Then how to describe this universe? Where it's homogeneous and isotropic. It's very easy to do, because for that you need only one function of time. And these kind of topics, okay, description of the homogeneous universe, I think people could include even in the primary school topics, yeah? Because it's really very simple. Now, so, to consider homogeneous isotropic universe, okay, we have to find first what is the class of homogeneous isotropic spaces we could use. And so, what is homogeneous? Homogeneous means that all points are the same. So you can go from this point to the other point, and you will find your local conditions to be exactly the same. What does it mean, isotropy? Isotropy means that it's a given point. When you look in different directions, you will see completely the same picture. Should space which is homogeneous be isotropic also? Of course not, because you could imagine universe which is contracting in the right direction, expanding into other directions. Then it's homogeneous, but anisotropic. Does isotropy means homogeneity? Again, not completely, because you could stand in one point in the center of spherically homogeneous cloud and see the same picture in all directions. But of course, isotropy in every point means also automatically homogeneity. Therefore, you could say either isotropic in every point or homogeneous isotropic. What is easy for you? Now, if we have this kind of space.
It's one up behind the top.
Huh? How is the way? Ah, okay, good. So, but it's fine. Then, what kind of evolution this space could have when you want to preserve homogeneity and isotropy? Well, first of all, what kind? For that, it's, of course, very convenient to consider two-dimensional analogy. What is kind of two-dimensional spaces, you know, which are homogeneous and isotropic? One space is, of course, flat, plane, right? The other space is the surface of three-dimensional sphere, because it's precisely what we need. Third one, perhaps you do not know why, because people cannot embed it in three-dimensional Euclidean space, but you can get it formally very, very fast. It's so-called Lobachevsky space. It's hyperbolic space of pseudo-sphere. Now, let's consider for simplicity sphere. So imagine that you are two-dimensional guys, and this third dimension you just need, okay, to present or to embed your picture. Then let's consider two points here separated by angle theta, AB, on the surface of the sphere. And let's ask what is the distance between these two points. So distance between these two points, AB, is equal to A, radius of the sphere, multiplied by this angle, theta AB. Now, of course, it's static picture. How this space could evolve if you don't want to destroy homogeneity isotropy? You cannot deform it like this one. The only way is to allow to this sphere to expand. So radius will be increasing this time. In this case, homogeneity isotropy will be preserved. How the distance will be changing? Distance will be increasing. And you could ask question, what is the relative velocity of these two points? It's just distance, okay, taken derivative with respect to time. Dot means derivative with respect to time. So it's A dot, theta AB, or you could rewrite the same thing as A dot over A, and then dAB. So A dot, don't means derivative with respect to time, divided by A, people call Hubble constant. A, people call scale factor. You see, it's two-dimensional analogy of the Hubble law. Now, and as you understand, you could take, for instance, plane, could do the same consideration, you would get the same story here. Now, how to generalize this law in three-dimensional space? You just write again the distance between two galaxies is equal to some scale factor multiplied by k, AB, what people call Kamuvian distance. Fact, it's on the sphere, in the case of sphere, it was the angle between two points. Now, from here, it follows that the relative speed of two galaxies is DAB point is equal Hubble constant multiplied by DAB, where Hubble constant is A dot divided by A. So this law also, if you would take it, you would find that it doesn't assume that there are privileged points in the universe. Because you could take 3 points, like this one, consider how this observer who measures the velocity of these two galaxies, okay, you will postulate that observer who is here measures these two galaxies velocity, so this velocity satisfies this law, then you go to the other point and you would find that the similar law is satisfies the same law for the other observer. You can make this exercise yourself. So the only thing, therefore, which we have to know to characterize the evolution of the homogeneous universe is the scale factor. You see, and therefore, we have to get equation for the scale factor if we want to find the evolution of the universe. How we will do it? For that, we need to use general relativity, of course. And general relativity, what it tells us? General relativity tells us that gravity doesn't exist in principle as a force, and everything, I mean gravity itself, could be just described as a curved space time. Here, when you describe homogeneous isotropic universe, the geometry which you have to use in general relativity should be the geometry which is compatible with isotropy and homogeneity. And as I said already, there are only three kinds of geometry. Therefore, let's derive metric element which describes homogeneous isotropic universe with a simple topology. So again, we will begin with two-dimensional analog. Consider sphere which is embedded in three-dimensional space. And let's get metric on the surface of this sphere. So what is metric? We will assume that this three-dimensional space has Euclidean metric. So it means that the distance between two points is given by dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. After that, we restrict ourselves on this two-dimensional surface, which has equation x squared plus y squared plus z squared is equal a squared, where a is the radius of the sphere. And then we'll rewrite this element in terms of x and epsilon coordinate only. Because you need only two coordinates to parameterize two-dimensional surface, right? So how we will do it? First of all, let's take this equation, differentiate it. Then we will get from here that dz is equal minus x dx plus minus y dy. What is that? That from here, okay, as it follows from here, it's square root of a squared minus x squared minus y squared. Substitute this thing now here instead of dz squared. dl squared you will get on the surface is dx squared plus dy squared plus x dx plus y dy squared divided by a squared minus x squared minus y squared. So this is the metric of Friedman universe. Closed Friedman universe. But of course you do not recognize it in this form. Therefore, let's play a little bit with coordinate to bring it in more convenient form. And by the way, Lobachevsky case corresponds to a squared is equal minus, is negative. So what we will do? Just instead of this x and y coordinate, we will take this point and introduce, take projection of this point, and introduce here angular coordinate. This point r prime we will denote, and this we will denote by theta. This angle we will denote by theta. So you understand, I take projection, and then, okay, this considers radial coordinate, r prime, this is theta. Then, in this case, it's instead of x and y coordinate. Then, in this case, x is equal r prime cosinus theta, and y, no, sinus theta, okay, so let's write here x and here y. So, and y is equal r prime sinus theta. So that from here it follows that x squared plus y squared is equal r prime squared. Or if you would differentiate these things, then you would get x dx plus y dy is equal r prime dr prime. You see, this thing you could immediately substitute here. Yeah? And take square, so you see that this element, okay, which looks complicated, is in fact very simple in this radial coordinate. Here, you could substitute immediately r minus r prime squared, and then dx squared plus dy squared. You know what is this? It's an realigned element on the plane, written in the spherical coordinate, so it's dr prime squared plus r prime squared d theta squared. Now you take this formula, substitute up, and then what you are getting? You are getting dl, two-dimensional, squared, is equal to dr prime squared divided by 1 minus r prime squared divided by a squared plus r prime squared d theta squared. So this is metric of two-dimensional, the surface of two-dimensional sphere. Now, if you would have three-dimensional sphere, how you would need to generalize this metric? It's very easy to do. You just add here one more coordinate, like this one, is three-dimensional sphere, d cos squared, and then make all these steps which I did for two-dimensional case. The only thing which will be changed here will be nearly trivial thing, so they will appear sine squared theta d phi squared. You see? So it's three-dimensional, it's the metric of three-dimensional sphere. Now, but it's metric of three-dimensional sphere when a squared is positive, of course, because radius should be always positive. But when you see metric, okay, first of all, you could ask question what will happen when a squared goes to infinity. When radius of the sphere goes to infinity, what happens with the sphere? Forget about some little things like topology, etc. Sphere becomes plane. Therefore, if you take limit a goes to infinity, you are getting a squared goes to infinity, you are getting 3D flat space. A squared larger than infinity, 3D sphere. But also, if you would take a squared to be negative, then you would not get any kind of imaginary things here, right? Therefore, formally, you could do it. And in this case, you are getting what people call three-dimensional Lobachevsky space. 3D or 3D pseudosphere. This pseudosphere, of course, cannot be embedded even in two dimensions. In two-dimensional case, in three-dimensional space, because sphere cannot have imaginary radius, but this pseudosphere could be embedded in three-dimensional, in a case when it's two-dimensional, yeah? In three-dimensional space with Minkowski metric. But usually people draw these pictures, of course, it's hyperboloid there, but they are not so explained. So, of course, you could draw the pictures, but what is the reason to draw the picture if it explains nothing, yeah? Right? Okay, so, now I will now introduce, okay, some kind of other coordinate, and we'll rewrite this metric twice more, so you will become familiar with it. First of all, Okay, let me introduce instead of radial coordinate, rescaled radial coordinate. Okay. Divided by absolute value of A squared, which is valid in the case of sphere and pseudosphere. Then, after you will introduce this rescaled radial coordinate, substituted here, you can rewrite metric, okay, for 3D homogeneous space in the form A squared absolute value, dr squared divided by 1 minus kr squared, plus r squared, and here I will write d omega squared, and you have to understand that d omega squared is the line element on the sphere with unit, two-dimensional sphere with unit radius, d phi squared, okay, it's by definition. Where k here is equal plus 1 for sphere, k is equal 0 for flat space, and k is equal minus 1 for hyperbolic space. So, you see that here you have what people call closed universe, flat universe, and open universe. But you have to understand that when people speak about closed, open, or flat universe, they mean the geometry of the space at the given moment of time. Okay, and this given moment of time is chosen in such a way that universe looks homogeneous and isotropic. Therefore, flat universe here doesn't mean that it's like Minkowski space. You know, it's quite an important thing because I recall this kind of argument in A between Linde and Hawking, which was going on for 1 week. Because Linde was telling that he is getting flat universe in these inflationary models, and Hawking was thinking that Linde is getting Minkowski space. And therefore, he was telling, I'm also getting flat universe, but it's useless because it will be empty. And because they meant under the same thing, completely different thing, okay, the clarification of the whole thing took 1 week. Could you imagine? So these kind of stupid things actually happen very often in community. I have also the other example. So the most trivial thing takes enormous amount of time to clarify because people keep in mind different things. Yes, now, this is a nice form for the metric on the sphere, but it's more convenient to rewrite it even in better form, introducing so-called radial coordinate, the other radial coordinate, which people use, so to go, we can go from high to high coordinate, where high is defined in the following way. D high squared is equal D R squared divided by 1 minus K R squared. So you see what is my purpose. Instead of this term, radial term for the metric, write something really very simple, differential of some function. And then you could integrate this equation for different cases, and then you will get this new rescale radial coordinates is equal arc sinus hyperbolic. In the case of hyperbolic space, it's just radial coordinate in the case of flat universe, and it's arc sinus normal a in the case of closed universe. So you see, in this case, ha, in the case of closed universe, is changing from 0 to pi. You understand? So, and also it tells us that this three-dimensional sphere describes finite volume space. It's like surface of the normal sphere, but three-dimensional analog. The area of the surface of two-dimensional sphere is, of course, finite, 4 pi r squared, so you could suspect that in this case, in the case of closed universe, also the volume of the three-dimensional sphere is finite, similar to the surface. And then, finally, metric would be rewritten in some form, which I will be using most of the time, like a squared. Now, as a squared, I understand just absolute value of the previous a squared. But why do I need to write all this absolute value? Because, okay, absolute value you need when you want to have some kind of physical interpretation of this A squared, but A squared has physical interpretation as a radius only in the case of sphere. So d chi squared plus, here I have sinus hyperbolic chi for the case of open universe, chi squared for the case of flat universe, and sinus squared for the case of closed universe multiplied by d omega squared. You see, I will be denoting, okay, these things as a function phi chi, normally, phi squared chi. So when I will be writing phi squared capital chi, then you have to understand that it should be one of these three functions in different cases, future. Yeah, good. So now, next question. Till now, I just described the geometry of static sphere or static space, which is homogeneous isotropic. Now the question is about possible evolution of this space. And as I explained already in two-dimensional case, the only possible evolution, which you can encode here, okay, which would preserve homogeneity and isotropy, is to allow the time dependence of this scale factor. You see? Because it's like change of the radius of the sphere. You know that if you would allow this thing to be time dependent, then nothing would happen with homogeneity and the isotropy of the space taken at the given moment of time. So, 1, 2, 3. I saw that there are more blue balls here. Ah, okay, I found one. So, evolution. A is a function of t. And then, of course, when you go to general relativity, then instead of just special distance, you have to write interval. In a case when you will take this coordinate system where the symmetries of the space are respected in explicit way, you could write the Einstein or interval, which you use for Einstein general relativity, in the following form. It's dt squared. Sometimes, which you introduce to parameterize the scale factor, minus dl3d squared. Or you could rewrite interval dt squared minus a squared t, and here we will write dr squared, okay, if you want one, minus kr squared plus r squared d omega squared. So, this metric is usually called Friedman, Demeter, Robertson, Walker, and then people suggested to it Einstein and a couple of other guys. I honestly try to discover why it's called so complicated. Because as you have seen, okay, to get this metric, even Keith could do exercise. And to suspect that mathematicians were so stupid at the beginning of last century, yeah, when in fact all mathematics was invented, is also a little bit stupid. So, of course, Friedman had this metric for the case of closed and hyperbolic universe. The only case which he missed in his papers was the case of flat universe. So the case of Euclidean space. The case of Euclidean space, after that was considered separately in 1932 in the paper by Einstein de Sitter. So sometimes people call Einstein de Sitter universe, okay? Trivial case, universe filled by dust, which is flat, universe confusing people who never heard about it. And I asked why actually there was invented this name, because when people say about de Sitter universe, they mean something really complicated, yeah? Not complicated, but nevertheless, actually, they mean the Sitter universe. So this name was invented by some astrophysics. I don't want, not invented, attributed to some astrophysics, whilst claims that perhaps it was not a very good idea. Now, all these three elements of the metric were described in different coordinate systems, because coordinate systems also are simple, by, in the book by Tolman in 1934. Maybe you know Thermodynamics, Relativity and Cosmology, which is an excellent book. Now, the papers by Robertson and Walker are dated by 35, 36. So, you could ask question what they added to this thing. It was also a question to me. Yeah, and also Weinberg asked me why I, in my book I didn't call it Friedman Roberts Walker. I asked him, but explain what for. So yeah, I also tried to read these papers, but they are unreadable. So the guys just actually using Killing Vector show that these three kind of spaces, yeah, are unique if you will restrict yourself by simple topology. So, and also, of course, most of the people just, they don't bother with all these things. They call it Friedman-Robertson-Walker elementary, et cetera, et cetera. Who cares? But nevertheless, if you use some names, you have also to take care actually sometimes about these names. What is their origin? Now, as I told you already, one of the things we described, homogeneous isotropic universe is the scale factor which we have to establish. But as you know, the curvature of space-time now is determined by the matter. And therefore, now comes second thing in the game, namely energy density of the matter. Because we can see the universe in large scales, who cares about elementary particles, yeah, in large scales? If you take this table, you will not be describing it using fermions and boson equation. How you would describe this table? Using energy density, pressure, etc. Therefore, in cosmology, in most cases, the only description which you need is effective description in terms of energy density and pressure. And, of course, we have also to know what people call equation of state. Namely, we have to postulate to find how pressure depends on the energy density. And this equation of state usually depends on the microscopic content of this matter. If you have dust, then pressure is equal to zero. If you have radiation, then you know the equation of state. I just love to ask it in the courses of statistics, in exams, the courses of statistical physics, yeah, where people know everything. Difference between microcanonical, grand canonical, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, ensembles, which I forgot already many times, but they have no idea that for radiation, pressure is equal to 1/3 of energy density. You see? Amazing thing. But nevertheless, actually, it tells something about professors who teach these courses, but not about students. First. So now, to determine two variables, we have to have two equations. Right? And let me, of course, one of the ways is just to write Einstein equation to substitute this metric Z to get so what people call Friedman equation, which are very simple, and then start to write. But I think it's more useful and illuminating way to get this Friedman equation without Einstein equation. You see why? Because as you understand, Newtonian theory should also be valid for some cases. Then see how these Newtonian equations will be modified if you would apply or if you would actually apply general relativity. But first of all, when we describe universe within Newtonian theory, this cannot be self-consistent theory. Because if universe is infinite, then gravitational potential which will be created will be infinite. Therefore, we have to use something from general relativity to justify this Newtonian approach. What we will use in from general relativity? Take infinite distribution of the matter. Take some small spherical hole in this matter. Ask question, what will be the metric here in this hole? The metric will be Minkowski metric. It's so-called Birkhoff theorem. So it means that outside hole, you could forget about all the matter. Now, in special relativity, not in special relativity, but in Newtonian theory, where everything is flat, basically, let's take and consider small ball, how it evolves. Then, of course, Newtonian theory also you could apply only when pressure is much smaller than energy density, velocities are much smaller than the speed of light, yeah? But nevertheless, in this case, when you will take infinitely small ball, you could expect even that the equation which you would get should be exact equation. Why? Because in the limit when ball is infinitely small, gravity becomes infinitely weak, velocity becomes infinitely small, and what you have to get? You have to get as a precise limit of special and general relativity, in this case Newtonian theory. But because equation do not depend on the size of the ball, how to reconcile this thing? So you could after that understand why equation which I will now get in Newtonian gravity precisely coincides with Friedmann equation. One of Friedmann equations, yeah. So let's consider ball of radius RT, which could be written down as scale factor multiplied by chi, where chi is commoving distance. Let's take some small particle on the surface of this ball. And let's write equation which this particle satisfies. So it's mass of the particle multiplied by acceleration is equal gravitational force which acts just from the matter from this ball, yeah, the central source. So it's minus g m. M is mass of the matter inside the ball multiplied by m divided by r squared. Now mass, auxiliary mass goes away, and now let's substitute this expression for r in terms of scale factor here. But before that, what we will do? Before that, what I will do following thing. Gm divided 4p divided by 3r cubed and multiplied by 4p divided by 3r. So it's clear what I did. I multiplied and divided this thing by this number, right? So then take this thing. What is this? Mass divided by volume is energy density, right? Now you see that here r and here r comes linearly, and therefore the commoving volume of the ball drops out, and you are getting Friedmann equation. Oh, wave disappeared. Okay, good. In the following form. Yeah, so you are getting from here A, A2 dot is equal minus 4 pi divided by 3 G, then epsilon multiplied by A. So this is one equation. Okay, which coincides, by the way, in the case of pressure equals zero, precisely with IK component, diagonal component of Einstein equation. Yeah, and we need the other equation. But the other equation we, in fact, don't need because we have already its solution. Its mass divided by A cubed, yeah, should be, mass should be conserved here. But let's just rewrite this thing, the conservation of mass in a little bit different form. Why? Because after that, I want to generalize this equation. From here, it follows that epsilon, which is proportional mass divided by A cubed, R cubed, yeah, proportional M divided by A cubed, scale factor cubed, because R is proportional to scale factor. Chi stays the same. Now, if I will take this thing, differentiate it, then from here, I will get that epsilon dot is equal minus 3 A dot over A epsilon over minus 3 Hubble constant energy density. So this is the energy conservation equation. And these two equations for two variables, in the case pressure is equal to zero, describe everything, describe the whole evaluation. So everything is extremely simple. Now, of course, we have not only matter with zero pressure. You know that the pressure which we have, by the way, in this room, according to these cosmological considerations, is zero, you could consider, because it also doesn't contribute to gravity. When I mean zero pressure, yeah, non-zero pressure, I mean really non-zero pressure, when it's some part of the energy density. You see, but these equations, of course, if you would forget about that energy, would be able to describe matter in our universe since recombination. You don't need anything else, basically. After that, you could build Newtonian theory of cosmological perturbation. You don't need general relativity. So if you don't care about too early universe, forget about this. Also, in Newtonian theory, there is other thing. I can use, of course, this equation, but interpretation of these things is a little bit different from general relativity, because here, scale factor in Newtonian theory has no absolute meaning. And also geometry here doesn't come in the game. You see? So, and, but nevertheless, we know that even today in early universe, for sure, radiation was extremely heavy, or not, was important. And also today we have dark energy. Therefore, we cannot use just Newtonian theory if we want to be objective, and we have to go to general relativity. And in general relativity, instead of all these equations, I, by the way, will make break. Yeah, I see that already people died, but in 10 minutes, right? Break 20 minutes and then after break, yeah? It's okay? Well, if you want, I, in principle, for me, it's not a problem. I cannot fall to sleep in front of this, you understand, right? So, if you want, yeah, I can continue. Okay, so in 10 minutes, so. So, in general relativity, of course, everything is in Einstein equations, okay, which looks like A alpha beta minus 1/2 delta alpha beta. A minus lambda delta beta is equal 8p gt alpha beta. I don't know what you expect from me, what I should do now about these equations, because most of the cosmologists in the books start to do, from my point of view, completely wrong thing. They start to make introductions to general relativity. I think it's horrible, because these introductions usually are not good. So second thing, if you know what is it, I don't need to explain. If you don't know, I also don't need to explain. So, why I wrote this, okay? Only because of this right-hand side, where enters the energy momentum tensor. Energy momentum tensor is defined very easily, yeah? It's something from what you could produce equation of motion for the matter. It should be symmetric tensor. And then in flat space, d alpha beta over dx alpha is equal to zero should give you equation of motion. So like second Newton law or earlier equation or whatever you want. You see, but if you want to get, for instance, equations which are earlier equations and even more complicated relativistic generalization of earlier equations, what you have to do? You have to take for the energy momentum tensor the following expression. Epsilon plus p u alpha u beta minus p delta alpha beta. Where epsilon is energy density and p is pressure. Therefore, instead of memorizing earlier equations, yeah, what people could do? They could memorize this simple energy momentum tensor and when actually professor will be asking to write earlier equation, just write, okay, these two things. In relativistic, and tell that it's even in relativistic, non-relativistic case. Now, also these things, of course, in addition, should be supplemented by equation of state, as I told you already, which you have to postulate. You know pressure is equal to zero, as I told, and epsilon over 3 for dust, epsilon over 3 for radiation, but there will be the other cases when pressure also could be different from both of the cases. For instance, you could have pressure is equal plus energy density. It's so-called ultra-hard equation of state. Why you cannot have pressure is equal to energy density? Perhaps you could, I do not know. But in principle, of course, it would mean also propagation of the signals with the speed larger than the speed of light. Yeah, now, you could ask me, is it everything what I need in cosmology to describe all kinds of matters? As we will see, okay, finally, yeah, it's really the case. It's everything what we need to describe the everything in cosmology. No, not everything. There is actually some processes with viscosity, but forget about these small scales, okay, like galactic scale, we can see the larger scales. But there is one more case which we have to consider separately, because if I will formulate it in terms of energy density and pressure, you will not believe me. It's the case of scalar field condensate, homogeneous scalar field condensate. You see, which also could be effectively reduced on the formal level to this energy momentum tensor. Should we consider some kind of fermions or something like this one? Tell me. No, of course not. Who cares? Photons, so vector fields. Why? Because in the case of fermions, you cannot form condensate, okay? which would behave differently from the hydrodynamical description of these contents of these fermions. In the case of photons, you could form something like quasi condensate, but you know that it's electromagnetic field. And if you would assume that this thing is relevant to cosmological scale, you cannot make isotropy for this thing. You see, the only field which could give you non-trivial thing could be compatible with isotropic homogeneity is the scalar field. And what is the scalar field? It's the simplest field, okay, which in principle people could write. But for a very long time, it was completely useless field, and then first time it became useful perhaps with the standard electrolytic model. And which was, by the way, on fundamental level, not yet discovered, but who cares also it's fundamental, not fundamental, if it can be useful, right? Okay, good. So now let me, okay, recall you what is scalar field. Scalar field, which is some variables, which is attributed to every point in the space at the moment of time t, which satisfies so-called Klein-Gordon equation. And in the case of massive case, it would be m squared phi here. Term, but in an arbitrary case of nonlinear field, is the derivative of what people call potential. Now, if I would take, okay, so this field, I would write action from which this equation of motion follows. And this action is integral 1 half phi alpha phi beta, where comma alpha means differentiation with respect to the appropriate coordinate with index alpha. Alpha goes from 0 to 3. 0 is for time coordinate, 3 for special coordinate. G alpha beta minus V, and then square root of minus G d for x. How can I get energy momentum tensor for this field? I have to take this action and vary it with respect to metric, and then what I will get for scalar field? I will get that T alpha beta is equal phi alpha derivative. Here indices are raised with metric. Phi beta minus 1 half delta alpha beta phi gamma minus V. Here, over repeated indices, of course, I assume summation. Now, where phi alpha is d phi over dx alpha, x alpha is t coordinate and xi coordinate, yeah? So, now, and then let me assume that phi gamma is positively defined. Then, in this case, I can take this energy momentum tensor and rewrite it in the form which completely mimics hydrodynamics. How it will look like? It will look like that for the scalar field, also the same formula, T alpha beta is epsilon plus P U alpha U beta minus P delta alpha beta, where epsilon is 1 half phi gamma plus V, P is 1 half phi gamma minus V, and U alpha is, by definition, phi alpha divided by square root of phi gamma. So you see, I have rewritten equations for scalar field in the form which mimic hydrodynamical fluid. So where P plays the role of pressure, and P is the difference between kinetic energy and potential, and energy density is the sum of kinetic energy and potential energy. Let's consider the case when scalar field is homogeneous. Because if you want homogeneous universe and you want actually the whole gravity due to the scalar field, you have to assume that phi depends only on t. How energy density looks in this case? Energy density in this case is given by 1 half phi dot squared. Dot means derivative with respect to time plus potential. And pressure is 1/2 phi dot squared minus potential. Right? Now, let's consider simple case, first of all. Let's consider the case of the potential, when the potential, okay, V has minima at some point. Yeah, at point phi zero, and the value of the potential at this point is V of phi zero. Then, of course, field could be here forever in the minimum of the potential, and in the minima phi dot is equal to zero. What will be the energy momentum tensor for this field? Energy will be equal V at point phi zero, and pressure will be equal minus V at point phi zero. So you see, what will be the equation of state in this case? Equation of state will be pressure is equal minus energy density. So you see, with the help of scalar field as extreme case, you are getting some very, very unusual equation of state, which you could postulate from the very beginning, but nobody would believe you, right? So in the case of this equation of state, how the energy momentum tensor will look like? Epsilon plus P will drop away, because P is equal minus epsilon. And here you would get, in this case, only this term, pressure, okay, which I could express through potential. So T alpha beta will be equal to V phi 0, which is constant, multiplied by delta alpha beta. So now, let's recall this Einstein equation and rewrite with the cosmological constant in a little bit different form. So R alpha beta minus 1/2 delta alpha beta R is equal 8pg T alpha beta, and I will include cosmological constant in the right side, plus lambda divided by 8pg, lambda, delta alpha beta. Now, compare the structure of the tensor structure of this term with the tensor structure of this term. You see, you could immediately identify cosmological constant lambda with 8pg and potential of the scalar field. So now you understand that in the case of cosmological constant, you could think that this is the minimum of the potential of scalar field, if you want. Or its hydrodynamical matter with effective equation of state pressure is equal minus energy density. And in this case, you don't need to write cosmological constant separately in Einstein equation, but just consider it as some special kind of matter. Correct? Correct. Now, the last remark before break. You see, you could consider the case of not purely phi dot equal zero, but you could consider the case when, for instance, phi dot squared is much smaller than V, but nevertheless is different from zero, right? Then what kind of equation of state you could get here? You could get that pressure is minus some kind of negative fraction of energy density. You see? Because these two combinations, by the way, for instance, if you would consider this thing and would try to write equation of state P is equal to W epsilon, then, from this kind of formulas, what could you say? In which range W could vary? No, when phi dot is equal to zero, then W is minus one. Now, when W is equal to zero, then W is equal to plus one. Therefore, you should clearly to understand, you should understand that in principle, W could vary from minus one till plus one, and this kind of variation or this kind of equation of state when W is in this interval, you can always justify either using hydrodynamics or scalar field. Moreover, on the formal level, you could mimic even pressure is equal epsilon over three, yeah, with the help of scalar field. And there are two ways to mimic this. You see, if you would consider lambda phi 4 potential, this I will derive later, And would consider fast oscillation of scalar field here, then equation of state in this case will be P is equal epsilon over 3. Yeah? So completely undistinguishable from what you have for radiation. Now, forget about potential. Consider scalar field with the action, okay, with the action which is Nabla phi. Nabla phi usually, yeah? So phi alpha, what I wrote here. But just, where it was, by the way, it actually disappeared. No. Okay, yeah, it's easy for me to say what this is. So it's Nabla phi action. Squared. You see, so it's quartic in phi. And then you could derive that the effective equation of state for this case also, as I just show you, P is equal epsilon over 3. So you could have radiation, you could have scalar field with potential, you can have scalar field without potential, it's the same equation of state. Why I told you about this? Because I want you to leave this room for the break and think about holographic principle, what all this bloody holographic principle means on the earth at all. Because in one case, you have entropy, in the other two cases, you don't have any entropy at all. You see, for this kind of homogeneous field. Okay, good. So now let's make 20 minutes break.